Hi, and welcome to the Macro Show. We talk macro, and you wonder, can gold really get to 1,300 an ounce? That's our headline story for today. Plus, we're going to talk again about the SLR rule. I spent the weekend really digging into it. I think I now have a much better understanding of it, why we have it, and how likely it is to get extended, and how about this really desperate bond market in need of any hope, any form of hope. We'll talk about it. Will the dollar come to the bond market's rescue? We're also going to touch on the CPI report coming this week. Everyone thinks there's a big relation between CPI and treasury yields, and the CPI is going to skyrocket. Is that true? Or is something else likely to happen? Plus, we'll talk about how hedge funds managers are positioned in the futures market and what is just a ridiculously large short position against the bond market. And why the shorts are so confident. Let's start out with the first story on gold. And yes, it is entirely possible gold can get to 1,300. And we're going to look at this in two different ways. For those of you who watched the Sunday chart show, you saw a bit of this. This is a volume profile. This just shows where shares are traded at what price level. And you can see this big support level here at 1687 says that the next level of support for gold is right here around the 1550s. But you see this red bar here? Well, it tells you most of the shares traded in gold futures are around 1,300 an ounce. And this is over the last 5 years, giving you a strong indication that a big unwind in gold could easily happen because there's not a lot of buyers out there. This big move higher was not done on a large number of shares. It was done on a small number of shares. So when prices come back down, they come back to where the buyers are at. Look for potentially gold going to 1,300. Now, if you say, well, I don't think that could even remotely happen, well, then you should really consider what's going on with the dollar. Now, let's take the 10-year chart of gold futures here, and let's overlay DXY. And what you find is they're not perfectly inversely correlated, but they do have somewhat of an inverse relationship. So when the dollar is high, it's tend to see gold being fairly low. And you'll notice a dollar back being up here at 103. Where was gold most of that time? Well, except right in here, where it was at 1550, it was down around the 1300s. Now, there are times where gold and dollar can go together. They can go down together too, up or down. But mostly when you see big moves in the dollar, that usually spells a lot lower prices in gold. And if the dollar could get back to 103, or even worst case, break out over 103, well, that would tell us that gold is very likely to head to 1,300, potentially lower depending on how big the movement is in the dollar. Now, what about bonds? If bonds are dead, are they over now? Or is the dollar going to come to their rescue too? Well, here's a chart using the same trade weighted dollar, or the not the trade weighted dollar, the dollar index over the last 10 years on a weekly chart with TLT hidden underneath here in the green and the red. And what you can see is they moved similar to each other. Now they're not perfectly correlated, but you'll notice when the dollar's going up, well, that means bond prices are going up. And generally when the dollar's going sideways, bond prices are going sideways. And here's a spot where they disconnected, but now the dollar came back down and bonds came back and they kind of met in the middle. And you see the dollar rallied and bonds went and fall, and now the dollar is starting to head upwards. We'll take a look at this a little closer on the dollar chart, and you can see dollar is starting to find some movement higher here. Don't have confirmation on momentum, but it broke over 92 today and is threatening to tag its 200-day moving average and then up over 93.50, close to 94. And that actually is a big boost to bonds. So all these people shorting bonds better watch out because the dollar is coming. All right, let's talk about this SLR thing, because the two hot topics for the bond market right now are this week's treasury auctions. We have tomorrow the 3-year, 10-year on Wednesday, and the 30-year on Thursday. So what is the market expecting? It's expecting a repeat of last, last week's 7-year auction, where it was very, bad, as we talked about. It was probably the worst 7-year auction in history. Now everyone's hoping the 3, 10, and 30-year are all equally large failures. Now, if they're right, which I don't think they will be, because I'm not 100% convinced that last week's 7-year auction didn't have some problems with the Fedwire issue the night before. So perhaps there were money that could have come in that didn't because of issues with the Fedwire. I don't know for sure, but we'll find out this week. So everyone's now upping their bets, saying that this 10-year auction is going to be a failure. The 10-year is going to spike. That's their plan. That's the hope. And they've gone all in on that. But what about the SLR rule? This is the other big issue that's coming up for the Fed. And we've talked about this several times. And this weekend, I really spent some time digging deeper into some of the experts and trying to find more information on it. And what I found out was, well, pretty interesting in terms of the timing of the SLR rule and why the real reason it might actually be here. And I don't think it's what most people think. Now, one of the problems with the SLR rule is that everyone thinks that the banks are dumping long-duration treasuries, which I've argued that I'm not sure they really own, because why would a bank hold a 30-year asset to match a 30-year liability it doesn't have? That doesn't make any sense to me. I could see them holding it temporarily to feed the Fed's QE engine, but beyond that, I don't see a large argument for that. But the view is that banks are selling those treasuries to buy short-term T-bills and notes. Now, let's go and look at something here from the Federal Reserve website. We've looked at this before, but this is really important to understand. Now, this is a press release going back to April 1st. So why did the Feds do this? Well, they excluded U.S. Treasury securities and deposits at Federal Reserve banks. That would largely be your QE, your reserve assets, from the calculation of the rule for holding companies until effective March 31st, 2021. Now, this is affecting the supplementary leverage ratio rule, or SLR. Now, let's go down here. And this is really where I think my view has changed. Liquidity conditions in treasury markets have deteriorated rapidly, and financial institutions are receiving significant inflows of customer deposits. That's important, along with increased reserve levels. So what are the increased reserve levels? Well, that's QE. The regulatory restrictions that accompany this balance sheet growth, important part, balance sheet growth, may constrain the firm's ability to continue to serve as financial mediators. Translation, the banks won't be able to provide liquidity to the market and do their job and provide credit to households and businesses. This change of the supplementary leverage ratio will mitigate the effects of these restrictions and better enable firms to support the economy. Now, where did this SLR rule come from? Because you're going to hear if you do any digging into it, you're going to keep hearing the terms like balance sheet constraint. You're going to find that everywhere. People talking about the bank's balance sheet. So you go back to the Great Financial Crisis. Who took the blame, right? It was the banks. And why that? Because they had too many bad loans and not enough assets to back them. So what we had is more bank regulation. And this time it was called Basel III. You can guess it's the third rendition of it. And inside the Basel III rules was the SLR ratio. Now, what was one of the purposes of the Basel III rules was to shrink or slow the growth rate of a bank's balance sheet, which is loans. You know, if the regulation can say, look, you can have these extra loans, you can have the risky loans, but you have to have more assets to back them and more high quality assets, that would slow the growth rate of the bank's balance sheet. Now, I want you to keep in mind, because you saw it in there in this lingo here from the Fed, balance sheet constraints, you saw that. All right, so what happened is when this law went into effect, QE wasn't an issue. Remember, that was my first view, was I think QE is the problem here, but it wasn't, because the Fed restarted QE in October of 2019. No problem. The SLR rule was in place. It didn't have any impact. In fact, interest rates went, you may remember, they went down. So obviously there was no negative effect of that. But why on April 1st did the SLR rule go into place? Well, you have to now back up a few days to March 26, 2020. And on that day, former President Trump signed into law the CARES Act. Now, what did the CARES Act do? Do you remember? It took a lot of money and did what? Put it into the hands of consumers and businesses, which would expand what? The bank's balance sheet, right? And that was going to be a problem. So it wasn't until that law got passed that a few days later, the Fed announces we're going to remove the SLR rule from part of their, or we're going to take treasuries and reserve assets from the bank's calculation in the SLR ratio. Now, this is important, right? Because the Fed is acknowledging the fact that, look, their balance sheets are going to expand, and we have all of these regulations, these global banking regulations to constrain the bank's balance sheet growth. And now all of a sudden we're giving them a bunch of money that's going to expand their balance sheet. What do we do? So they pass the SLR, so they change the SLR ratio around temporarily. Now, why did they go on a year? Yeah, remember, was a pandemic supposed to last this long? It wasn't. Was a recession supposed to last this long? No, it wasn't. It was supposed to be gone by now. So the Fed always gives themselves extra time. Anytime they make some changes to ease restrictions, they always want to go longer than they need to because they want to get to the point where no one's using that tool. Right, so if there's an odd problem in the repo space and they expand their repo offerings, they'll leave them expanded until the point where, hey, no one's been using it. No one's been using it for a long time. So I guess we can get rid of it. That's how the Fed likes to operate. So here we're coming up against this again. Now, a lot of people, including myself, have asked, why hasn't the Fed extended the SLR exclusion even further? Because the Fed's a reactionary agency. They don't like to front run things. What if, for some reason, the $1.9 trillion stimulus does not actually go through? Well, then the Fed doesn't need to change anything. Now, they probably would, but that's how the Fed's thinking. It now appears, probably by next week, before the Fed has their meeting on the 16th and 17th, that the stimulus will be passed. And what will that stimulus bring? More money into the banks. It will expand their balance sheets. And guess what? They can't handle that. So if you look at what the Fed could do, they could extend the SLR, which the markets would deem bond bullish. They could reinstate it and then do some other things. But here's what the Fed normally does and why I believe they will extend it is because it worked the first time. Now, maybe it wasn't the perfect solution. Some people said it really wasn't that effective. But in the Fed's mind, it doesn't matter. If something does the job they needed to do, they will keep doing it. And Congress can't force them not to extend or to shut it down. They did, remember, back in December when the prior round of stimulus passed, the Senate took away some of the Fed's toys, and they're going away now. They're going away at the end of this month. But this is one, it's solely up to the Fed. Now, there's another interesting article that came out today on Zero Hedge that suggests that perhaps this liquidity problem that we've talked about is going to go away. So economist Lou Crandall writes this morning that as Congress gets closer to passing the $1.9 trillion stimulus, the Treasury won't need to raise much new money to finance it. Now, this we all kind of knew, right? It wasn't that hard to do the math. This also means the government's cash surplus problem is about to resolve itself. And he goes on to say the Treasury's current coupon offerings are generating more than $2.7 trillion of new cash on an annualized basis and still sitting on a large stockpile of cash. We already know that. But since it is now seems clear the Treasury no longer needs to pay down bills, it's talking about Treasury bills, as it needs to start pre-funding the 1.9 stimulus. So what you're seeing is Wrightson suggesting here that Janet Yellen's going to be reactionary too. He estimates the Treasury will start increasing the sizing of its bill offerings, T-bills, in the very near future, maybe as soon as Thursday. So that would be interesting too, because we know the banks are short T-bills, which could be another reason they are selling off some of their longer duration, not specifically they're out at the end of the curve, but just any duration. Perhaps a problem why the seven-year auction wasn't that great, because they need to go get T-bills. In effect, this means the liquidity drain that was envisioned for this quarter by the Treasury is no longer happening, but is about to be reversed as the Treasury reassesses its funding needs and restart building up its cash buffer. So in practical terms, this means the pace of pace of the Treasury's weekly bill paydown will collapse from $55 billion to negligible levels by the first half of April. And sure enough, this is already being observed in the market, where Treasury bill yields have backed up and securities maturing through April 1 are yielding 0.02 to 0.03%, meaning the expectations for negative repo yields can be cast aside and the short of the curve will now widen in the coming days. And since there's no longer going to be a flood of liquidity the dealers will have to absorb, it means there will be far more capacity for regular coupon securities. In short, a flattening curve is imminent as lower 10-year yields and by extension higher stock prices, as this move will likely be viewed incorrectly by algos and quants as a disinflationary trade. So there's some view that perhaps what we're going to see from the Fed and the Treasury are reactions to Congress passing the stimulus bill, which would make sense. That way, you know, it's like I said, again, if Powell doesn't want to come out and do something and be front running it and act like that because it's not what the Fed does. So my expectation, even if it doesn't do much, he will likely extend it and we probably won't get that answer until next week's FOMC meeting. All right, let's talk about the concern about the CPI being inflationary. And for that, we have to don the crown because this is a big misconception, is everyone thinks the CPI is the barometer for where interest rates are going. And it's not exactly true at all. In fact, the relationship between the two is pretty weak. So here we have the money multiplier in blue and consumer price index, and the money multiplier is trending lower. So on Thursday, everyone's expecting now a blowout move in the CPI, and the money multiplier saying, look, you can probably go up, but you're not going to go up a whole lot. Now, we do know by May that even if the CPI runs flat, that due to the shutdown of the economy, the year-over-year rate could easily pop to 2.5%, but it won't stay there. So will we see some upward move? If we do, don't expect it to be a lot, because where the CPI really falls is the core CPI, which excludes food and energy. So we know the main CPI really has been a little hotter than we would actually expect it, because energy and food prices or energy costs are up, food prices are up. But look at core CPI, it's rolling and over and headed down. In fact, it's kind of trending along the money multiplier here quite nicely. So now let's go forward and compare the CPI versus the core CPI. And you see the core in red is fairly stable in terms of how wild the broad CPI moves around it in blue. And you can kind of tell that, hey, as the core heads lower, that so too will the CPI. Now, does it mean the CPI can't pop up as the core is flat? No, or even go up as the core is going down? No, it certainly can, but whatever moves higher will be transitory. Now let's overlay this against 30-year treasury yields, because this is the one relationship everybody thinks is solid, but if you really ran a correlation against them, you'll find out it's not really correlated at all. And so what you can see here is there are periods where the CPI can rise and yields can fall. And you see here yield rising quite a bit, or CPI is rising quite a bit. Yields aren't going up that much. You can see there's periods where they go down together. Here's a period where yields down, CPI is kind of was flat. So there's no real relationship here. The whole, you know, and you got to think about this. If we're in a liquidity trap, is it possible that higher consumer prices would be met with lower interest rates because people need lower interest rates to afford those higher consumer prices? Yeah, and that was what you would see right in here. How about against the core, which is, if you're gonna compare yields to anything, you're much better off comparing it to the core CPI. And even then, you can find places here where the core is headed higher and yields are headed lower. And there's just not a real strong relationship between these. All right, let's move on to how hedge funds managers are positioned. So all that tells you is whatever the CPI is coming out on Wednesday that everyone's hopped up over about, it doesn't really have any long-term relationship with treasury yields. All right, from our friend Brent Johnson at Santiago Capital, we got the net positioning of the 30-year, the long bond, in the futures market, and speculators increased their short positions as of Tuesday. So if you remember that big spike in bond prices last Tuesday, well, that got heavily sold by speculators. And here's that chart. You can see they increased their net short position down. Still not back to their all-time net short, but we can presume that this is still headed lower. And then from our buddy Skyway, who likes to chart the same position. So this is Brent's chart here, right? What you're seeing is here, you're seeing the net short position increase, and this is TLT. So you can see this net short position has just been an anchor around TLT. How about the short sale of the century? Treasuries further saw a record increase in net speculative short positions last week. The biggest record move in short positioning last week, and people say the interest rates can only go higher and higher. You have what, my friends, is the largest bet against the bond market in the history of the bond market. And here's another chart adding Eurodollar futures. You can just see the biggest bet against this against the bond market is occurring as we talk right now. Here, let's take a look at from Hedgeopia, 10-year treasury note futures. This is likely the quants going for the CTAs going from long to short. We knew that could happen if the 10-year got to 1.5%. They did. They went to max short positions now across all the CTA space. Here you can see the 30-year back down again. We saw that on Skyways and Brent's chart. The WTI, surprisingly, no one's chasing this up in the futures market despite higher crude oil prices, as everyone is worried now about supply constraints and inflation from crude, which we expect to see some of that in the CPI, but we're definitely not going to see it in the core. Hedge funds went long the S&P 500 last week, as of last Tuesday, And let's see, euros down. Oh, speculative positions in euro futures are down 9%. That is bullish for the dollar, bearish for gold. How about gold? Yep, they dropped their positions down too. So we're seeing gold, as I said, you know, it's got a destination potential with 1300. Be interesting to see. How about the NASDAQ? With it falling down, we're seeing short positions start to build up there again. And the Russell 2000, they're increasing their shorts a bit. How about the dollar? Well, they're backing off their short positions. The dollar's got a long ways to go here from a very, very deep short position. And this could be huge, huge for the bond market and really bad for the broad equity market. And last but not least, VIX futures. Man, they took even bigger short positions over last week. And that is a dangerous game. So with that, we will stand against all the enemies, against the bond kingdom, because when our day comes and all these short sellers are reversed, there will be glory to the kingdom and we will triumph as their kingdoms melt down under the biggest short squeeze in the history of the bond market. And you'll be here with me as we see it together. Thanks for being fans. Thanks for watching. Hope you enjoyed today's show. And I will see you on Wednesday, which should be a very interesting macro show because we'll have the CPI data. And of course, we'll have some bond auction data to talk about. I'm Steve Van Meter. Thanks for watching. Bye now. Content of this video is provided as educational information only. It's not intended to provide investor or other advice. Shares not to be construed as a recommendation or solicitation by our selling security financial instrument or to participate in any particular trading strategy. So it was paired by Steve Van Meter. Personal capacity opinions expressed in this video that do not reflect the view of Atlas Financial Advice Inc. or Steve Van Meter Financial.